Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 148. I'm recording it on Monday, July 13th, 2009. The P10 level today is 16. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The music for the podcast is by Kevin McLeod at Incompetech.com. The title of the selection is Awesome Call. The title of the podcast is Sarah Palin. She is me. I don't usually talk about politics. I talk about investing in most of the podcast, although ultimately I hope to have a podcast on saving as well. Saving and investing, money management. And I don't think, I actually have made an effort in my time at discussion boards, at the Retire Early and Indexing discussion board communities, to avoid discussion of politics. Some of these boards do turn to discussions of politics, and I have always found that to be a bad idea. Because what happens is you're trying to achieve a goal. You're trying to learn about the subject matter of the board, and people talk about politics, and then they start including in their posts little digs about the other political candidate and this sort of thing, and you get all this hostility and friction, and it detracts. It holds the board back. It detracts the board from achieving its goals. So one thing, I've always been in accord with Mel Lindauer. Mel Lindauer is my friend over at the Bogleheads.org board and also at the Vanguard Diehards board, and co-author of the Bogleheads Guide to Investing. And Mel and the other leaders at the Bogleheads.org community have been pretty tough about limiting political discussions. They allow a little. I don't think they allow any political discussions, but they even limit some other things. But if it even gets close to politics. And they've taken some flack for that. And that's one on which I've always been happy to defend Mel and the others who do that. Because they're trying to build a discussion board community, not on politics, but on investing. And the two don't mix. And I think he's right. And I've always backed him up on that. However, since the stock crash, September 2008, the issues of investing, economics, and politics, and even culture to some extent, have melded, and internet regulation, they've all sort of melded. You can't talk about one intelligently without making at least some reference to the others, because because we're in a crisis. They call this an economic crisis, or at least they were calling it that back in September, October, November, December, January. Since the stimulus bill's gone through, they've sort of backed away from that a little bit. People aren't using the word crisis so often. People feel that things have stabilized. I think we're still very much in a crisis, and I think we will be for some time to come. And crisis means something. Crisis means It means everything's up for grabs. It means you've got to go back and rethink fundamental questions. And when that happens, it's not just our stock board, it's not just our retirement accounts that are in jeopardy here. Our system of government's in jeopardy. I mean, I hesitate to say that because it sounds like such an overstatement. It sounds so melodramatic. And it doesn't help at all to be more dramatic than necessary, but I don't think it's too much of an overstatement. If middle class people were worried about the retirements before the stock crash, and it's, you know, I think there's a good chance we're going to see another big stock crash in the years ahead. And if there's another big stock crash, people are not going to have the money they need to retire, and they're going to be upset, and that puts our economic system in jeopardy. Already we see the government taking over industries like the auto industry and the banks and this sort of thing. And that's a big change. Healthcare, that's a big change in our economic system. And there are people saying that the political system is broken down. The political system is not responsive to problems. All this partisan bickering. And I think there's a lot of truth to it, although, you know, as I say, I have a podcast called The Good Populism, The Bad Populism, and populism I favor to an extent, but when it becomes angry, then all I can tell you is, brother, count me out. So I don't think it's going too far to say that even our political system is being questioned in some quarters, and that may get worse. In the event that we go into a major depression, a depression of the size of what we experienced in the 1930s, the American political system was questioned in the 1930s. That's a fact. There were communists running for office, socialists running for national office and getting votes, getting significant amounts of votes. And that's going to happen again if we see a second major depression. So you get to a point where you can't avoid these political questions. And I haven't worked out totally how to address it. I don't want to encourage discussion of politics. And I won't. And, you know, at the blog, we're going to discuss financial freedom, saving and investing, and not politics. I'm not going to go into a debate about whether Sarah Palin is a good candidate for president. That's, or vice president, or whatever the case may be. That's not relevant. But I'm talking about Sarah Palin in this podcast for a particular reason, and I'll get to that. But we can't leave out politics entirely. So in other words, there's going to have to be some, we're going to have to come up with some rules for what can be said and what cannot be said. And I don't want it to be partisan. I don't want it to be bickering. But there has to be some discussion of how are we going to achieve political solutions to our economic problems. And one of our big economic problems is the failure to correct the errors made when the passive investing model was developed. There was a belief when that model was developed that the efficient market theory was a reasonable theory. That theory has been totally discredited over the past 28 years by the academic research, and yet we still recommend passive investing, and it's destroying our economy, and it has to change. And to, you know, that becomes a political question. So the particular question for me is, I started out, you know, very innocently asking a question about safe withdrawal rates back at the Motley Fool board, and I was proven right. The old school studies are analytically invalid. They get the numbers wildly wrong. And then no one corrected the studies. Instead, they just said, let's shut down discussion. Let's not let anyone know that we got these numbers wrong. And that sort of, radicalized me. I sort of said, what's going on? This is strange. We're not going to give people accurate numbers for retirement at a retirement board? Makes no sense. And I, you know, started digging, trying to figure out what was going on. And what I found is that there had been academic research showing that passive investing, the idea that you don't need to change your stock allocation in response to big price swings, had been discredited by the academic research dating back to 1981, 28 years ago. It wasn't 28 years ago then. It was, I guess, 21 years then, but it had been discredited a long, long time ago. And yet, the stock selling industry was still promoting this idea. And lots of people who were not in the stock selling industry had heard it promoted so much, they believed there must be something to it, and they were promoting it, including John Graney. And so I started digging deep and found, you know, all the material that I found at the that's at the website, all the insights that are developed at the website, and became convinced that the most important thing we need to do today to help people achieve financial freedom early in life is to open up the internet to honest discussion of the flaws of the passive investing model so that everyone can learn both sides of the story and decide for themselves whether they want to invest passively or rationally. To invest rationally is to take valuations into consideration, to take the price of the stocks you buy into consideration when setting your stock allocation. That's what I call the rational model, and that's the model I explore at the website. So I tried at the retire early boards to open these boards up, you know, to discussion. And we had lots of people support that idea, thousands, hundreds who contributed to the discussions and helped us develop all the wonderful calculators and all this sort of thing. And thousands who expressed the view that they would like to see honest posting permitted. But we also had a group of very determined, very angry, very hostile, very abusive defenders of the old school methodology and of the passive investing model in general. And they insisted on a ban on honest posting, and they achieved that at the retire early boards. And then we moved to the indexing discussion boards, and they achieved a ban on honest posting there. Ultimately, it took years, but ultimately they did achieve that. And then I've been, in recent months, in 2009, putting up guest posts in the personal finance blogosphere. And the Grainy Goons, John Grainy is the author of one of the old school studies, the Grainy Goons have now moved into the personal finance blogosphere. And they're saying we must have a ban on honest posting on the flaws of these studies in all personal finance blogs throughout the internet. And a number of the owner, a number of the owners have said no. They've gone ahead and they've permitted guest posts pointing out the flaws in either the old school studies, the retirement studies, or in the passive investing model in general. But there also there have been other blog owners who have gone along with the demand for a ban, which is incredible. It's just an incredible reality. So I have come to the conclusion that I'm going to need to move to political blogs to get more attention to, you know, to our situation. And I'm not going to be doing that right away. I have some other things on my plate, but I expect by the end of this year I will be contacting some political blogs and asking for help to get the internet opened up again to honest posting on investing questions, including the flaws in the passive investing model, including the academic research of the last 28 years showing that long-term timing does work. That, you know, while there is indeed evidence that short-term timing does not work, the same historical data shows that long-term timing has always worked, and in fact is required for those hoping for some realistic chance of long-term investing success. So I expect to be moving into the political blogs by the end of 2009. And one of the questions that's come up is which blogs to contact. And most political blogs, they tend to be... they tend to be partisan. There aren't too many blogs in the middle. They tend to be either hard right or hard left. And I don't feel comfortable with either hard right or left or hard left. And so I don't want to identify the retire early movement or the indexing movement as a conservative movement or a liberal movement or a libertarian movement or an independent movement or whatever. I really don't want it to be any of those things. I want it to be a financial movement, a personal, you know, financial freedom. That was the whole idea. Part of the reason I got into this is I felt, how could, you know, you won't have any of this divisiveness, any of this anger, because how can anybody be against financial freedom? But the joke was on me, that's for sure. I've been debating in my mind for the past month or two, what sort of blogs am I going to contact? And one idea I came up with is I would contact both. I would, maybe if I contacted 10 blogs, I would make 5 of them liberal and 5 of them conservative. And that way it's sort of balanced. So that's a possibility. I may still go that route. Or I can just contact as many as I have time to contact, and whichever ones help us, you know, side with those. If conservative blogs help us, great. And if liberal blogs help us, great. That's another way to go. Or you could try to find some moderate blogs. I could make more of an effort to try to find some popular moderate blogs and go for those. So there are different options. But an option that is starting to have some appeal to me is to appeal to supporters of Sarah Palin. Sarah Palin, I'm recording the blog July 13th. Sarah Palin gave her resignation speech July 3rd, about, I guess, 10 days ago now, where she said she'll be stepping down as governor of Alaska at the end of this month. And it's not crystal clear what she'll be doing. It sounds as though she's going to be, possibly making speeches on behalf of different candidates and, collecting, I presume, collecting IOUs that way, getting some, you know, getting different candidates to sort of line up with her. That's I don't know any details, but she's writing a book, giving speeches, I suppose, you know, and building a political, you know, building a political infrastructure, perhaps raising money. I saw something came out today about money she's been getting through her PAC or something like that. So I don't follow that in any detail. But there are things about, well, I love Sarah Palin. I'll start with that. I love Sarah Palin, and I probably should start with a little description of my own political views with the caveat that I don't like doing it. I don't think it belongs in a personal finance site, but I don't think it can be avoided given the nature of the circumstances facing us today. But I'm not going to be encouraging our movement, our retire early movement, to go down the road of exploring politics. That's not a good idea in my view. But I don't think we can avoid it 100% at this point. I just don't. I just think it becomes artificial at some point. It's the political issues are there, and they need to be discussed. And in the case of Sarah Palin, I think there are some particular issues that I'll try to lay out in this blog, and I'm sorry, in this podcast. But my background is I was raised in a Northeast Philadelphia. It was a Democratic neighborhood. Immigrant neighborhood. John Kennedy is probably the candidate who's, you know, my guess is the most popular candidate, say, in the neighborhood where I grew up, you know, ever in my history, my lifetime. It's a John Kennedy sort of neighborhood. And I remember John Kennedy. I was young, but I remember seeing him on television. I remember, it's strange how you have these, oh, I always find it strange what things stick in your head. You know, you when you go back to when you were 4 years old, let's see, I was born in 56, so Kennedy was elected in 60. So, yeah, I remember watching television. My mother was there, and I was watching television, and she was watching the show, and I just looked at it, and he gave that statement about ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And I remember hearing that. And that must have been 1960, so I was very young. So it amazes me how these things stick in your head. But it does. You know, I guess somehow you sense that there's some significance there, and it sticks in your memory. So I started out definitely on the liberal side, and I worked for George McGovern. I became political myself when I was in seventh grade. My older brother gave me a book, 1984, to read, and I had never read a serious book that hadn't been assigned for school. That was the first book I read on my own that was serious, you know, not a sports book. And that book shook me up, scared me, and I sort of got interested in politics, and I think that was, yeah, that was 68, so I guess I was 12, I was in 7th grade, I think. And so I got interested in George McGovern's campaign. I followed him, and used to read Rolling Stone. I think Rolling Stone endorsed him, so that was good enough for me, you know. So, you know, started out sort of liberal. Became a journalist, and I became more conservative over the years. I don't want to go through a long history, but, you know, I voted for a mix. I mean, I voted for, one of the things I thought was funny, I say I'm a big Sarah Palin supporter, so I obviously voted for McCain this time, and it struck me funny. I wondered how many people voted for Mondale in 1984, and, you know, McCain in 2008. I'm sure there are others, but I voted for, I liked Ronald Reagan. I have a lot of respect for him. I like his anti-Soviet Union stance. Not really anti. Anti is the wrong word, but he would say, trust but verify. I just love that. That's me. Trust but verify. It's like a warm, you know, an inviting, welcoming, but I'm going to be careful. I like that. That's the mix. I go for that. So I like that about Reagan, but I never voted for Reagan. I voted for Carter, and there were things I liked about Carter. I don't want to go on and on, but I liked it. I liked his informality, I know, and I think he was focusing on the budget at the time when he was running. So I liked things about Carter, and I what I liked about Mondale, I think I probably would have voted for Reagan in 84, except he picked Geraldine Ferraro as his vice president, and I'm a big believer in women in politics. And the day he picked Ferraro, I said, I'm voting for Mondale. That's the end of the story. There's nothing else to discuss. So that gives you some. I mean, you know, everybody's got these quirky reasons for how they vote for people, but that's me. I'm a big believer in so Sarah Palin is well, I'll go into that as we go. But so I voted for probably more Democrats than Republicans. I was registered Democrat when I was young. I don't vote for. I'd say today I vote for more Republicans than Democrats. Today that's changed, but I don't think I've ever registered Republican. I just left it, or I don't think when I moved to Virginia you had to register as a party. That's my recollection. I'm not sure, but I don't think I've ever registered Republican. But I vote Republican more often than Democrat today. I'm more conservative, and the two things that pushed me in the conservative mold, one is the abortion issue. I am pro-life, and it's hard to be pro-life in the Democratic Party. I think that's sad. I think that's sad. I wish there were more pro-life Democrats. That's sad to me. There are obviously things in the Republican Party that turn me off. I think reading between the lines, you can tell. You know, I'm not into. The Republican Party is known as the party of, you know, the wealthy. And so that doesn't appeal to me too much. Not that there's anything wrong with being wealthy, but just I tend to think politics is there to help the downtrodden and the middle class. I think those are the people that need help, that need a break. In other words, the wealthy, I feel to a large extent, can accomplish things through the free market. So I don't feel that they, you know, they should, there should be political rules that you know, protect fairness and things like that and protect opportunity. But I see the role of government as largely being to protect the downtrodden, the poor and the middle class. So I've never really felt comfortable as a Republican, but as I say, I sort of feel I've been, you know, Reagan himself said, I didn't leave the Democratic Party, the Democratic Party left me. So to some extent, I feel that way about it. I feel that I've been sort of pushed out largely because of the abortion issue and also because of the Clinton, Monica Lewinsky issue, the whole impeachment proceeding. That was a major turnoff to me. So that's my, you know, political situation in sort of a nutshell. Not most of that, not relevant, but I'm just giving that background to get to the Sarah Palin matter. Now, Sarah Palin is somebody that I don't have any ambivalence about. Sarah Palin, I love, and probably I would say that there's never been a candidate that I felt such enthusiasm for. Now, perhaps I'll be disappointed. You know, it could be we don't know a whole lot about Sarah Palin, and it could be a year from now I'll look back at these words and I'll think, "Oh my God, did I say that?" Well, if that happens, that happens. All I can say is that I like everything about her. I just think she's wonderful. I think she's wonderful, and I think we need her. We need what Sarah Palin has in politics so badly, so badly. So I am, you know. I actually stopped following politics. Part of the reason I got into personal finance is that I used to be a lobbyist, and I got sort of disgusted with and a journalist really for more years than a lobbyist. But I got sort of disgusted with the political process, and I said I don't want to do this with the rest of my life. And I said I want to do something that helps regular people. And I thought helping people how to achieve financial freedom, that's the way. And so that's how I moved into personal finance, and I stopped paying attention to politics. I used to. There was a time when I read four newspapers a day. I used to read the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Washington Times, and the Wall Street Journal almost every day. I remember when I used to visit my parents in Philadelphia, I had to read the. I could skip the others, but I had to read the Washington Post, or I didn't. It was like not brushing my teeth, and I used to get on the subway and go downtown to get it. It would take me an hour each way, but I had to read the Washington Post. So I was very into politics at one time. I wrote a column at Tax Notes Magazine on tax politics. So I even wrote a column about politics, but I got disgusted by it. And I got to a point where I paid virtually zero attention to politics. And that continued until last, when Sarah Palin was picked, and I was on vacation when she was going to give her speech her convention speech, and I hadn't watched a political event in, I don't know how many years, close to 10 years. And we had come back from the boardwalk, everybody was exhausted, and I wanted to get some sleep. And I said to my wife, I said, I want to stay up and I want to watch the speech and let's see, let's put the television on, see when it's going to come on. And it wasn't going to come on for another 2 hours. And she was like, you're an idiot. Just go to sleep. Read about it in the paper. You don't have to stay up and watch it. And I said, I don't know. I said, I got to see this. I got to see this. And I thought it was an amazing speech. It was said under, the speech was given under somewhat difficult circumstances. People had been attacking her daughter. And I thought it was a wonderful speech. And then, it was a second time that happened. They, of course, the knives were really out after Sarah Palin later on at the time of her debate with Joe Biden. And they were ready to, if she had made a mistake in that debate, they were ready to kick her out. I mean, they were ready to just get rid of her altogether. And so I felt her whole career was on the line. I said, how could you not be nervous? And she had a slight bit of nervousness when she started that debate, but she got over it very quickly, and I thought she did amazingly well. And I have to say, I very much like Joe Biden. I felt Joe Biden, I think I had the sense Joe Biden warmed up to her very well. He really liked her. And she liked him. And I thought that was great. That's what I like. That's how I like to see people behave. And so I want to talk a little bit about what Sarah Palin represents to me and why I'm giving thought. As I said, I haven't made a decision to contact the Sarah Palin blogs, but I'm giving some thought because I'm thinking it may be a way of getting attention to the problems of what passive investing has done to our 401k accounts and to our economy and possibly to our entire political system, the damage it has done. And we need to get people talking about it, and I don't feel that we can count on people in the personal finance blogosphere to do it, because a lot of them seem to want the links. They want to be buddy-buddies with all these big shots. And all the links go to people that endorse passive investing. That's where all the money is. That's where the stock-selling industry is, and the stock-selling industry has hundreds of millions of dollars to generate, to promote this junk, and I think it's fair to call it junk. It has no intellectual integrity. I mean, it did at one time. But I haven't found anyone who can make a rational argument. I'll stand up and debate anyone. I'll debate John Bogle. I'll debate Bill Bernstein. I'll debate Scott Burns. I think these people believe in it. Please don't understand me. But they know there are problems, and they won't debate it because they're scared. They're scared. They can't hold up their end of the discussion. It's true of this guy, J.D. Roth, at the Get Rich Slowly blog, a good guy in general. But I've had discussions with him, and he can't hold up his end of the argument. And so he just says, we need some people with intellectual integrity. We need people who understand that these issues are serious, that when you get the numbers wrong in a retirement study, people suffer as a result. And that has to be fixed. We have to get the numbers right. If we don't get the numbers right, we cannot have intelligent discussions about how to invest effectively. If we can't agree to get the numbers right, it's like we can't agree how to spell words. How can you communicate? How can you write letters to each other if we can't even agree what the words are? This is the ABCs. So that absolutely has to change, and I think we need to get, I'm going to do a separate blog on the institutional problem that these blogs in the personal finance blogosphere, they're all sort of compromised. Not all of them, but a lot of them. And some of it is just that they don't understand. There's clearly, that's a big, big factor. That's probably the biggest factor. But some of it is they don't want to understand. And that's different. If you don't understand something, that's life. But if you don't want to understand, you are failing your readers deliberately. You're saying, I don't want to understand because I don't think I'll get as many links and I won't make as many bucks. And that's an integrity problem. And that has to be addressed. And I think the only way we're going to address it is to get people talking about it at the political blogs. And it's a political issue. If our economic system goes down, that's obviously affects politics. So it's a political issue. You know, this isn't just an investing issue. When the investing experts get the retirement numbers wrong and don't correct them for 7 years after it's public information that they are wrong, you have a policy issue in your hands. Somehow we have to turn this around. So the question is, you know, as I mentioned earlier, there's different ways of proceeding and none of them are perfect. My feeling is the great thing we have on our side in this great safe withdrawal rate debate project is that it's a win-win-win. I always say this. Everybody in the world benefits if we allow honest posting on investing on the internet. Everybody. Even people who agree, you know, who favor passive investing, they win because if they have strong arguments, they're going to win, you know, they're going to win the argument. I mean, I obviously don't think they're going to win, but presumably they do, or they wouldn't believe in passive investing. So if they think they're going to win, then what harm is there in allowing honest posting? What possible harm could come of it? They'll just sharpen their arguments. They'll become that much more effective, but they don't. You see, they don't have confidence. I really have to say, I don't think there's ever been a passive investing advocate I've run into who has confidence in his ideas. Maybe there's a few exceptions, but the vast majority are highly defensive. And that's, to me, a clear signal that these ideas are weak, that these ideas are on the way out. They're on the wrong side of the history train. So Sarah Palin represents something. And I think, of course, she's been misrepresented in terms of what she represents. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about what I think she really does represent. And, you know, part of the question here is, as I say, I don't want to get into partisan politics because it's first of all, I find it boring. That's probably the biggest reason. I just find it boring. So I'm just not going to engage in it. And I don't want others to engage in it. I don't want people wasting their time. But two, it distracts us from achieving financial freedom early in life. And the goal here is to achieve financial freedom early in life. So, you know, partisan politics is not the idea. I support Sarah Palin because she is against partisan politics. Now many people will find that a shocking or even incredible statement. She's a polarizing figure, okay? I was talking to somebody about this at a picnic yesterday, and I made a statement, you know, it just sort of came to me, but I think it's absolutely true. It's not a shocking insight, but I think it's funny. But I said, look, Sarah Palin is the second most popular politician in the United States today. And that's just a fact. You know, Barack Obama is the most popular by far. But Sarah Palin is second, and there's no one else even close. I think third would probably be Hillary Clinton, but Sarah Palin is there's no question she's the second most popular, and people are saying her career is over, you know, her political career is over. She's the second most popular politician in the country. Now, the other side of the story is she is also the most hated politician in the country today. That's also a fact, a clear fact. So that clearly is a negative. In other words, if you're running for president and you're the most hated politician in the country, that's a downside. So that's fair. But being the second most popular politician means you are a player. There's just no, I think it's absurd. All these people talking about her career is over when, you know, all they can do is talk about her. To me, this is just crazy. It's just like the safe withdrawal rate debate. And there are strong parallels. You see, part of the reason I think I got interested in Sarah Palin is I saw the parallels with the great debate. That there's this issue that nobody wants to, not nobody, but a lot of people don't want to talk about. Big shots don't want to talk about. That's what it comes to. There are a lot of big shots that don't want to talk about certain issues. And when somebody comes along and raises them, their response is not to talk about the issue, but to destroy the person. And so with the Great Safe Withdrawal Rate debate, they knew from the first day that those studies were flawed. And they said, rather than fix the studies, we can't discuss it. If we discuss it, the flaws are going to be revealed. Let's destroy Rob Bennett. That's what we'll do. Destroy Rob Bennett and destroy anybody who posts in support of him. Destroy anybody. And they did the same thing with Sarah Palin. In other words, the argument that, you know, she's not qualified, you know, she doesn't have enough background, that's a legitimate point. I mean, you know, it can be argued. I think she has the background, but Some others don't, and you can argue it both ways. Just as on a lot of investing questions, you can say, should your allocation be, 30% or should it be 50%? You can argue both ways. But you can't argue that valuations don't affect long-term returns. That's not a reasonable position. And you can't argue that Sarah Palin is not a serious political force, given the millions and millions of people that feel an intense love for her. To say that she's not a serious political force is just, it's just crazy talk. And the more crazy talk people engage in, the angrier they get, because of course then they feel, well, if I speak crazy talk and it's revealed to be crazy talk, it makes me look bad. So then they're all worried about making themselves look good instead of figuring out the realities. And so I really see a parallel there. And I think that's, I think that parallel is probably the reason why my attention was drawn to the Palin pick in the first place. I saw the pick and I saw the reaction to her, and it happened almost instantly. The reaction was instantaneous, and I said, something's going on here, and it sure reminds me of something else that I've been involved in. So I see a similar dynamic going on in the Sarah Palin saga and in the Great Safe Withdrawal Rate debate saga. And the similar dynamic is there's someone coming on the scene raising some new questions. Someone not really tied to the establishment, the institutional forces, raising some new ideas and getting great response. Sarah Palin's had great response among the voters, not all of them, but a large segment of them. And I've had great response, among many community members at the Retire Early and Indexing communities, but not all of them. And the establishment figures, the quote-unquote leaders, the big shots, have said, we can't allow this. This is too, there's questions being raised here that are not good for us to hear. Not good for us for these things to be discussed. And we really can't handle it in terms of, engaging in discussion, reasoned discussion. We have to destroy the person. We must destroy the person. This politics of self-destruction. Wanderer used to talk about the Borking of different political figures. When Robert Bork was put forward as a Supreme Court justice nominee, and the idea was not to address his political stands or his, I guess with a judge, you really should be looking at his record of, decision-making as a judge. Instead, attack him personally. Destroy him personally, and then other qualified candidates won't want to step forward. So we sort of kill two birds with one stone. We get rid of the candidate we don't like, and secondly, we prevent other candidates from coming forward. But of course, we damage the system when we do this. And this shouldn't be a question where liberals or conservatives or moderates have different viewpoints. We all should be united in saying, wait, this is our system. This is our political system. We want it to work. We don't want Borking of people. And we don't want smear campaigns on internet discussion boards. We want to learn. We want to achieve financial freedom. So I want to talk about some of the things that I especially like about Sarah Palin, the positives that I see there. I think the single biggest thing is that she doesn't engage in this sort of thing herself. Now, some will say she does. Some will say, she attacks. She was the vice president candidate, and the vice presidential candidate is the attack dog, but she doesn't attack in a mean-spirited way. She's tough. And I like to think I'm tough. When I argue against passive investing, I've sometimes got 20 passive investing advocates on the other side, and I'm the only guy in the room arguing against it, and I've got my hand tied against my back because the site owner is saying, we're going to ban you. If you say anything we don't like, the other side, they can threaten to kill you. We're not going to ban them. But if you say anything we don't like, even if it's perfectly within the rules, you'll be banned. And we've done it. Don't think we won't do it again. And in that sort of environment, you have to be tough. And I try. It's my job to, if I'm going to help the community, I have to be making the strongest case I can make against passive investing, because the passive investing advocates aren't going to make it. You're not going to hear it unless I do the best job I can do. And I think Sarah Palin feels that way when she, you know, criticizes whatever the policy matter is. But she always, at least in my experience, through my eyes, your eyes may say different, through my eyes, she always does so fairly, in a dignified, respectful, affectionate way. She doesn't attack people's children, you know. She doesn't smear people. She says, I don't agree with your policy, and she points out why the policy is bad, to be sure, and sometimes in strong language. But I feel that it's the sort of thing that where she's on the right side of the line. So that if everyone behaved that way, the system would work better. People would argue their sides, but at the end of the day, we could all be friends. And at the end of the day, we could all recognize that we're on the same team. And I feel that this is how politics was in the United States in earlier times. It, of course, there was always divisiveness. There was always some anger. I mean, these things are part of human life. But there was I think there's been a change in recent decades where there's more of a feeling of bitterness, and there's more of a feeling of a divide. There's more of a feeling of polarization. There's more of a feeling of you can't be my friend. You know, if you don't agree on such and such an issue, you can't be my friend. And now we're seeing that. First of all, you know, we're seeing the divisive stuff on the internet. So the borking isn't just aimed at political candidates. It's aimed at just ordinary people. You know, just some ordinary person who happens to put a comment on a discussion board, and that person will be destroyed. Their reputation will be destroyed. Their, you know, lies will be put about their personal finances all over the internet. Just because they happen to disagree with someone on an investing question. Ugly, ugly, ugly stuff. Where we've taken ourselves as a society. And non-productive. It's not only ugly. I mean, I don't think that should be ignored. I think the ugliness it's offensive, and I think it should be commented on. But even worse, it's so unproductive. Because how do we learn? You know, something I've pointed out on numerous occasions is all learning comes from acknowledging getting something wrong. If you know everything, you can't ever learn. You know, you might think it'd be great. You know, say an angel came down from heaven and said, I can put you in a situation where you never will have to say you're wrong about anything. You say, well, that sounds good. Well, what it would mean is you're never going to learn anything. Because if you're right about everything today, you can never learn. All learning comes from, you know, either acknowledging you got something wrong or acknowledging you just didn't know. You didn't have an opinion and you didn't know anything. But you can't say, you know, if you're going to say, I know what works in investing, passive investing is it, well, you can never learn. Why go to a discussion board if you know it all? What's the point? So I'll just point to some of the traits that I think are important. I think the number one trait that Sarah Palin has is this cheerfulness. And I think that just hits people. It's not, you know, people always talk about her being attractive. And, you know, I don't think that's such a big deal. I mean, I think it's a factor. Attractive politicians do better than non-attractive politicians. But the real thing that I think she has going for is that she comes across as a positive person. And people see that, and that's part of the attractiveness. When they say she's attractive, I think a lot of times what many people mean when they say it is that she's so positive. She's got a radiating smile. And they see that, and yes, it does come in an attractive package. I mean, that helps. But I don't see that as the dominant thing. But this positive feeling is something that I think people are crying out for. People don't feel they can be led by haters. They don't feel confidence in haters. And they need to hear somebody positive, somebody kind, somebody warm. I think we need that in the investing realm. And I think we all need to work to bring more of a kind spirit and a warm spirit and a loving spirit to our investing discussions, because I think we all will learn more if we do that. And as we learn more, we will achieve financial freedom sooner. So there's a financial payoff. You know, you don't have to do this for altruistic reasons. There's a financial payoff. But the other thing that I think is just... the Sarah Palin story is that she truly is nonpartisan. Now, you know, some people won't see it that way. They'll say, well, she's conservative, and she is conservative. But her record in Alaska was working with the Democrats. That was what made her so popular. And that's what she's tried to do on the national level as well. You know, this wonderful time when she spoke on this abortion question and you know, pointed out that she herself, the thought crossed her mind of not having that child. That's a reaching out. And I think that's how we heal the wounds. You know, we are a wounded society. All societies are wounded because any society that's trying to accomplish something is going to have battles. And whenever you have battles, you're going to have scars. And whenever there are scars, there needs to be healing. But the leaders are not the people who fight. You do have to fight. That is part of it. And Sarah Palin does fight. But you also need to be able to reach out the hand of friendship. You need to be able to reach out the hand of kindness. That's part of it. It's got to be a balance. And I see that. I saw that in the debate with Biden. And she was asked, you know, what she thought about this bill on gay marriage in California. And, you know, she said she does not believe in gay marriage, but she believes that gays should have, you know, equal rights on benefits and all this sort of thing. And they asked Biden the same question. He said exactly the same thing. He says, I don't believe in gay marriage, but I believe in equal rights, equal benefits. That should have been the headline. That should have been what everybody was talking about the next day. Because that's where you build. That's where the society comes together and says, well, okay, we have disagreements. We have strong disagreements. And let's not paper them over. Let's not be babies and pretend we all agree. But look, we've got some things we agree on. We should focus on the agreement. We should never paper over the disagreements. We should be honest. But we should focus on the agreements. Well, think if we did this in the investing realm. Can Rob Bennett find areas of agreement with Mel Lindauer? Sure can. I think it'd be fair to say we agree on more than we disagree. We're both huge Bogle fans. We can find dozens of things on which to agree. Why not do that? Instead of focusing on the negativity, focusing on the disagreement. We shouldn't paper over the disagreement because that's how you learn. You learn by saying, look, you know, these two people who agree on so much, they have this one point they disagree, this valuation question. Let's explore that. Let's figure that out. But first you have to start by assuring everyone about the agreement, the respect and affection, the mutual respect and affection, which is where you build from. And I feel that she sends that signal, that that's what she's about. Now, not everyone's going to agree when I say that, but that's what I see. You know, if you want to know why I am saying, Sarah Palin is me, she is me, that's what I see, rightly or wrongly. As I say, if I someday come back and say, no, it's not there, I was wrong, well, then I was wrong. But I see that today. I see it strongly. She is me came from a bumper sticker. I just saw it somewhere. I was driving somewhere and I saw a bumper sticker. Sarah Palin, she is me. And I thought, man, that's just great. I mean, it's nice and short and it's informal, but it says the message. She is me. I think that there are millions of people in this country today who are worried about these questions. They're worried about not how we solve the particular political issue. Obviously, we'd like to have perfect solutions to every political issue, but we all know that's not realistic. If we solved every political issue in the book today, we'd have a whole new group of them tomorrow. New book of controversies. So it's not realistic. But what we need are process. We need to have a way of going about solving these problems. And I think it's feeling respect and affection for the other side, understanding that people come from different sets of life experiences and that we can learn from them and that we're better with these people than without them. We're better with these people speaking their minds than we are silencing them. We need to have enough self-confidence to hear the other person's point of view. Now, I saw a little bit of this from Andrea Mitchell. She's a reporter with NBC News, television news. And she's made some snarky comments about Palin, I believe. But she interviewed her last week after the resignation, and she was on one of these talk shows yesterday. I saw a clip today, and I thought her comments were much more balanced than what I've seen from her in the past. You know, it was sort of like she wasn't agreeing with Palin. Wasn't saying, oh, I've come around all her viewpoints. That would be preposterous. You know, just as it would be preposterous for Mel Lindauer to say, starting today, I agree with valuation-informed indexing. But she was human. She was pointing out, she was discussing Sarah Palin like a human. And that sounds so basic, but it's these basics where we're in trouble. You know, the game they play with Sarah Palin is what people want to hear, what people are interested in is, you know, is she the best candidate? Let's look at the pros and cons. That's what we do with others. But with Palin, they feel we have to take it back a step. Discuss whether she even can be discussed. In other words, is she so below the level of what can be discussed? That's a game. Is she so below the level be discussed that we can't even listen to her? And so they change it. And of course, that's what they do with the valuation question. They say, anyone who raises valuations is insane. Anyone who raises valuations must be banned. It's the only thing they'll ban somebody for. You can engage in any obscenities, any hate speech. You won't be banned. But mention that valuations affect long-term returns and you'll be banned. It's beyond the pale, beyond the pale. They move the goalposts, essentially. Not because the person has nothing to bring to the table, because the person has so much to bring to the table that they're not sure they can respond. But of course, if they do respond, there's two ways it can go. The person might convince them, in which case they learn something, and that's wonderful, or the person might fail to convince them, in which case they have that much more confidence in their arguments. But the worst way to go is to say, let's take this issue off the table. See, that's gamesmanship. And it's not effective. And it's not human. It lacks integrity, and integrity is part of the human experience, and it lacks intelligence. Intelligence is part of the human experience. When we go to these smear campaign tactics, we give up our humanity. So says Rob Bennett. And of course, they create a circus atmosphere, and that's part of the goal. This is something they'll say about Palin. Well, circus atmosphere follows her everywhere she goes. But she didn't have a circus atmosphere before she was picked, before her speech at the convention. She never had a circus atmosphere until then. And of course, I never had a circus atmosphere prior to May 13th, 2002, when I showed that the old school retirement studies get the numbers wrong. Why was there no circus atmosphere then? Because there was no need for a circus atmosphere. The establishment figures were not threatened before somebody came forward and pointed out that their methodology was wrong. Yeah, we saw a thread today at Bogleheads, and it was amazing. And I linked to it at the Today's Passion thing, but the Today's Passion feature of the site. But it was a thread, and somebody was talking about this stuff. Jeremy Siegel. I mean, the whole thing is shocking. Somebody, I think it was Jason Zweig, had a column the other day saying that Jeremy Siegel got the numbers wrong. Where have you heard that phrase before? In what he's claimed about stock returns dating back to 1800. And, you know, it's good that Zweig wrote the column. It's wonderful. But it's a little late. You know, did nobody think to look at this for... The book came out in 94? It's 2000, 15 years? Where, you know, where were all these experts for 15 years? We're learning this now after the biggest loss of middle-class wealth in the history of the United States. So the whole thing is just appalling, shocking. And, so somebody brought it up at the Bogleheads, and it turned into a discussion of Shiller. And, I mean, Mel Lindauer, it was sad. I mean, it's so pathetic. It's sad. He's just... You know, people were making points about Shiller, and some think Shiller's right on, and some think he's not. Some are skeptical, and that's all part of the game. That's all fine. But Mel gets in there and just says, oh, Shiller made a bad call. Shiller got it wrong, and I've gotten it, you know, I've been shown to have gotten it all correct, all from the start. And it's just so pompous. It's unbearably pompous. And I just, I read the words and I, you know, I make my living in writing and I have my whole life. And I think, is there any other field of human endeavor in which such pomposity could even exist? And it exists because no one will say it. No one will say it. They're all afraid. And his friends won't tell him. You know, his friends won't say, Mel, you sound awful. You know, patting yourself on the back. Is your arm going to fall off? You know so much more than Robert Shiller. You're so much more advanced. And you've got friends everywhere. Bogle's your mentor. And you work with all these geniuses. And nobody's ever known what you know. And it's just intolerable. It's intolerable. And it's, of course, it's, you know, I it's bad for the people who listen to it in that they're, you know, they suffer the financial consequences, but it's bad for Mel. Mel has made many contributions. He's at, you know, 20,000 posts. I don't know, some big number. Why can't anyone try to tame it? And I think what happens is he gets more pompous as the evidence accumulates more that he's wrong. This is what happens. In other words, it's sort of like a self-destruction thing. I saw this with Grainy. I saw him destroy himself in front of my eyes. And I said, is there no one here who's willing to send this man an email? Does he have no friends? And I wrote him emails. I tried. But I didn't get the feeling there were many others who would do it. And we have to figure out what that is all about. What is going on in our society that we are allowing people to destroy themselves in this way? We have to do that. And there's a parallel here between the political realm and the investing realm. And I'm pointing out some of the common, you know, dynamic, but I don't understand it all. You know, there's something going on in our society. My sense is there's some kind of cycle. It's a growth cycle for a culture or a society. And what happens is we start out humble. We start out trying to advance, and we do. We put our human intelligence to work, and we achieve great things. And at some point, we become full of ourselves. You know, we just start thinking we know it all. And this is when the so-called establishment starts to gel, you know, and you can't question it. And then we start to decline. All these bad things start to happen. And everyone's sort of mystified. They're saying, well, I thought our system worked. What's wrong here? But it's the same system, but the people are different. And then it becomes impossible to address the problem. And eventually the problem gets so bad, the whole system just explodes. It just blows up, and everything collapses. You know, stock market collapses, or in the political realm, the political system collapses. It loses the confidence of the people. And people think it's all over. Then people think it's all over. Then they're like, well, it's the end. There's nothing. But then what happens is a wonderful thing happens. When everything collapses, when you think it's finished, all of that pent-up energy, that pent-up positive energy, things people have been trying to put forward for 20 or 30 years, now can go forward. So just as you had destruction at a level you couldn't have imagined, all of a sudden, you have good things happening at a level you couldn't have imagined. And you see this, you know, if you look at history. I mean, we did this, the greatest, the most insane bull market prior to the one we're trying to recover from today was the one of the 20s that led to the depression of the 30s. And a lot of people felt the United States was over in the 30s. The depression was the end. But when the depression came to an end and then the war came to an end, say in 46, we had a period of huge economic growth. And I think that's what we're going to see this time. If we make it to the other side, if we work together and try to solve these problems together, we will have the greatest, the golden age of investing for the middle class investor, I believe, is coming up ahead. I don't know how far up ahead. It depends on us. It depends on the humans. It depends on whether we can tackle these problems, whether we can work up the courage and the grace and the love and the intelligence. But if we can do that, we can do great things. And so I don't think it's a good idea to keep putting it off. I think we really do have to get down to business. And I'm going to give a shot, as I say, I have some other things on my plate. But later this year, I'm going to give a shot, at least tentatively, I've decided, to contact some pro-Palin blogs and see if we can get them interested in this economic story that hasn't been told, that is sort of kept out of both the mainstream media and the blogosphere. And the failings of the passive investing model and the ban on honest posting on the internet on these questions and the errors in the old school retirement studies. And see if we can make some progress that way. And ultimately, you know, get things going in a positive direction. And we'll see. But something on my mind, and I thought I should lay it out there, and as I say, I don't want to turn this into a political site at all. But I feel that the question we do have to solve the political problem as well as the economic problem as well as the investing problem. They are in a sense connected. Certainly, you do not have to be a Palin supporter to participate in our discussions. We welcome all political stripes, and we need all political stripes to go forward to learn. But in terms of getting our message is an anti-establishment message. It's the establishment that has pushed passive investing. And it's the establishment that has said, you know, we should not allow discussion of the flaws. And it's the establishment that has been dragging its feet about getting these errors and these old-school studies fixed. And so I think we need a bit of an anti-establishment voice carrying our case. And the wonderful thing we have going for us is that rational investing is to every single person's benefit. We all get to retire a year sooner if we can open up this discussion to more reasoned debate. But the problem with that is when it's to everyone's benefit, there is no one party that's going to promote your message. This, you know, the idea of rational investing is not a Democratic idea. It's not a Republican idea. It's not a Libertarian idea. It's an idea that helps everyone. So there's no one claiming ownership of it. But it's possible that Sarah Palin represents a new form of politics where there'll be a little more openness to new ideas. And if we can get this new idea on the table, I think we can do some wonderful things for lots and lots and lots of people, so including ourselves, to be sure. So let's you know, I'm going to consider that. And if you have thoughts, if you think I'm crazy, wacko, let me know. If you think it's a great idea, let me know. Use that Contact Rob button at the left side of every page at the website, passionsaving.com. Good luck with your investing strategies. Take care, my friend.